at UBC. She did her first degree at the University of Toronto, then a master's degree at UBC and a PhD in anthropology at UBC. In between, she also managed a diploma with distinction at the Scott Polar Institute, the University of Cambridge in England. For more than a decade, she lived in the Yukon Territory, where she worked with the Yukon Native Language Center, recording oral traditions and life stories with Athabascan and Tlingit elders. I think that the combination of Klondike Gold First Nations oral tradition in the title tonight is responsible for our large audience. Working closely with these elders, she prepared booklets under their authorship documenting family history, place names, land use, social history, and other subjects that are largely absent from history books. The theme of her talk tonight comes from lengthy discussions with elders' memories of the Klondike Gold Rush and how their accounts contrast with written documents. Her work, though, has had a much broader extent than strictly working in an anthropological context. She has been advisor to numerous panels. She has presented various professional reports on such subjects as the role of Northern Canadian Indian women in social change. She has been a witness at a number of formal inquiries, including the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry in 1976, the Alaska Highway Pipeline Inquiry, and preparing papers for the Council of Yukon Indians. She submitted them to the Yukon Court of Appeal in the matter of the Constitutional Questions Act and Yukon residency requirements in 1986. It would take too long to go through even a fraction of the curriculum vitae I have before me, and I think the best thing now is to call on Professor Julie Cruikshank to speak about the discovery of Klondike gold, contributions from First Nations oral tradition. Dr. Cruikshank.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? No. Aha. Now, is that clear? Good. No. All right. See. Now I'll try again. Is that sounds clear. I can hear it myself. Thank you. Well, I'd like to begin by thanking the Vancouver Institute for asking me to give this evening's lecture. It's a real pleasure to be here and to be able to talk about this work with you. The issue I want to talk about tonight centers on Canadian popular history, how it gets written, and how once it gets written, it has a kind of taken for granted status, at least for some people, but not for others necessarily. I want to do this with reference to a particular example that will be familiar to many people here, and that is with reference to stories about the Klondike Gold Rush, which centered on the period of time between 1896 and 1898 in the Yukon Territory. But I'd like to make the focus of my work, or my discussion tonight, some of the work of Tagish and Tushone and Tlingit elders, who've been my teachers in the Yukon Territory for the last 25 years while I've been working with them. They've been involved in documenting their perspectives on a number of historical events and a number of topics, and have been very concerned about making these part of Canadian history and incorporating those understandings into history as we know it. If I could just begin with some background, I had the good fortune to live in the Yukon for more than 10 years in the 1970s, and it was a really exciting time to be there for me. It was exciting because First Nations were beginning to become very articulate about their concerns about land claims, about curriculum matters in schools, about self-government, and there were a number of young people who were very concerned about documenting historical background to make these particular claims in their negotiations with the federal government. Because I had a background in anthropology, I was very fortunate to be able to be involved as one of the researchers in this work, mostly for the Yukon Native Language Center, which was administered by the Council for Yukon Indians. And one of the things we were trying to do was to have elders be able to document their traditions and have those incorporated into school curriculum. One question that preoccupied all of us during those years, and particularly First Nations researchers from communities in the Yukon, was the kinds of evidence that were available for writing history. The Yukon Archives was beginning in those years in the 1970s, and it's a magnificent research center. It incorporates materials from all the historical writings that are available, the written kinds of documents, personal diaries, account books, record books, but it's a very restricted kind of history. It's often very ethnocentric, and those accounts and diaries are usually written by people who spent a very short period of time in the Yukon. So the question that really preoccupied all of us in those years was the question of, was this one, essentially, in areas of the world where documented written history is really very recent, how can contributions from oral traditions from elders who've lived there and who have experienced these events, how can these become part of the historical record? And what can they contribute to our understanding about historical understanding, how we represent the past to ourselves, to our children, to our grandchildren? In Northern Canada, it really is possible to hear contrasting accounts about a number of events that have occurred, some in the past, some in the more recent period of time. And inevitably, one will be found in the written record, and another in the daily conversation of elders in communities who are discussing these incidents with their children and grandchildren. So the possibility of incorporating orally narrated accounts into historical writing was really exciting for a number of us in those years. I think it's more complicated than we thought it was then, but it was something that a number of First Nations students were very concerned about doing as well. Most of my work involved working with elders who wanted to record family history, place names, land use, life stories, a number of things that they wanted to record, partly for family and partly for use in schools as well. And one of the really sharp points of contrast, and the reason I've chosen this topic for this evening, was around the Klondike Gold Rush, because there were very, very different perspectives about what had happened at that point. I think this is striking because there is this kind of take-it-for-granted quality to accounts about the Klondike Gold Rush. In the Yukon, there's a celebration each year. While the rest of Canada celebrates, has a national holiday on the first weekend in August, in the Yukon, it occurs 2 weeks later on August 17th, which is a Discovery Day. It's known as Discovery Day, and it's a kind of celebration that has can-can girls and Klondike gold pans, and it's very much in the genre of frontier history, representing one part of that history. This is going to become more important because the centenary of that discovery of Klondike gold will be celebrated in 2 years, in 1896, and so we'll be hearing more and more about Klondike Gold Rush history. So the question that interests me really is how that will be represented, how it will be represented in the Yukon and to other audiences across the country as we hear more about this. There are, again, a number of contrasting stories that emerge from this period, but tonight I want to talk about just one set because I think they present a real contrast. Stories about the discovery of gold, the discovery that triggered the Klondike Gold Rush. There's one set of these in the written record, and in fact, the Yukon Archives has a very extensive set of histories about the Klondike Gold Rush. That's probably the main documentary evidence and material that's there. But there's another set in oral tradition, told among elders in the communities. And I want to talk about them, not so much to talk about the event, the particular event, but to talk about what they show us about social process, the social process in which colonial encounters take place in the North and in other parts of the world, and the way those encounters get passed on, some of them enshrined in history books and passed on in that way, and others passed on in oral tradition from individuals to other individuals. I'll begin with some slides now. Thanks. Can you see that at the back? Good, thanks. I think events surrounding the Klondike Gold Rush, or events surrounding successive gold rushes in California, in British Columbia, in Alaska, and in the Yukon during the mid-19th century have a kind of fascination, a particular fascination for Western audiences. This is especially true for the Klondike Gold Rush because it occurred in 1896, right in the middle of a very serious world depression. It gave hope to a number of unemployed people who felt that they had no possibility of finding jobs. So that while there's a singular glamour associated with gold, I think this particular gold rush has had a particular interest because of it, because it seemed to give so much hope to people at that point. It's been called, let's see how this works, it's been called a poor man's gold rush, and the term poor man's gold rush is used over and over again. It didn't require a lot of technology. Many people said all you needed was a pair of rubber boots and a gold pan in order to be able to go and possibly find gold. And so a number of people who didn't have a great deal of resources, a great number of resources, were able to go ahead and they had to provide a certain number of evidence that they had a certain amount of food with them and to take it in with them. But all that really seemed to be required was to have the hope that you could go to this distant part of North America. And so people, egged on by dreams of finding gold in the creeks, headed off. A number of people also made money. In fact, I think the people who made money probably made money by outfitting for the Klondike Gold Rush. But this slide, I think, illustrates an example of geographical confusion which surrounds those kinds of expeditions. It seems unclear whether the Montreal outfitters thought they were the Klondike was north or south of the equator. But I think it illustrates. I think this slide really illustrates something about the process of what was going on during the Gold Rush, because it makes it really clear that the gold rush was part of a larger, much less glamorous process, essentially the expansion of the Canadian state into the margins of so-called margins of northwestern northern Canada. Very few people who did go as gold seekers actually found gold. Most of the people who staked claims staked them almost immediately after the gold was discovered. But the most long-term effect of the gold rush really was the establishment of a framework for administration of the new capital, Ottawa, in northern Canada. And the institutions that date from this time continue to have an effect on all the people, especially the First Nations people who continue to live in the Yukon Territory. For those who are interested in finding out where the Klondike was, the San Francisco company invented this game. It was played much like Spin the Tail on the Donkey. And it was sold and marketed in 1897. You can see that there's a problem with spelling on it. It's called an amusing and instructive, misspelled game, but it was to instruct one where the Klondike was, apparently. The Gold Rush did produce an enormous literature, but in thousands of written pages, we really find very few references to the indigenous people who were living there at the time. Between 1896 and 1900, somewhere between 30 and 40,000 people, would-be prospectors, traveled to this one small area, the center of the bullseye here, on the Klondike River. The vast majority took the same route. They came up by boat, they climbed over the Chilkoot Pass, they built boats on the lakes at the head of the river system, the Yukon River system, and then they traveled down the river to Dawson City. But we're really left to imagine what the impact of this torrent of visitors was on Aboriginal people who were living along the route. There is a lot of documentation about the effect on the coast, where there's documentation of the epidemics that were occurring at the same time. But there isn't that kind of record in the Yukon. That material wasn't recorded and passed on in any way. But the stories we'll hear tonight will really indicate, I think, that the devastation from those epidemics was having an enormous effect on families in the Yukon as well. Stories passed on by word of mouth from Aboriginal people may enter the written record at some point, but they've been largely absent from that record until now. One reference to Aboriginal people that does occur repeatedly in the written accounts refers to the discovery of Klondike gold. The initial discovery is very controversial, partly because there were competing claims around that discovery, about who actually discovered the gold at that time. But certainly, it's interesting to me that it's talked about as a discovery and as an event. Knowledge that gold was there already existed. It had been mentioned by a number of people. There was a fur trader named Robert Campbell in the central Yukon in the 1850s, and he found gold around Fort Selkirk. A couple of other people. who were in the Yukon. There was a missionary named Robert McDonald who found gold in the 1870s on Birch Creek, right on the now Yukon-Alaska border, but that's not seen as a discovery. A geologist named George Dawson, who surveyed the Yukon and traveled through the Yukon during the 1880s, found gold in a number of places, and he predicted that there would be a major gold rush at some point. But the term discovery is reserved for a particular event that happened at a particular time. It always refers to the same event, and that's the almost accidental location of gold on a small tributary of the Klondike River in amounts large enough to signal a major rush. Now, names of Aboriginal people do turn up in this account. The names of the people who do turn up in the written accounts are always the same. Skookum Jim, whose Tlingit name we'll hear later, was Kaish, but he's always referred to him in the records as Skookum Jim. His sister, Kate, their nephew, Charlie, who was a daughter of a son of a sister of Kate and Jim, and Kate's non-native husband, George Carmack. The stories about Skookum Jim that appear in the written record present him as some kind of a sort of frontier folk hero, a self-made man, a kind of prospector. When you hear about him, invariably one hears about him in the kind of imagery that's associated with prospectors. His activities are often described in the written record and symbolically interpreted as though how remarkable it is that such an improbable individual could find gold and become wealthy. And I think there's something very interesting to be said about the representation in these accounts. The oral accounts from his own community give a very, very, very different picture of Kaish or Skookum Jim. And I think that this is an interesting way and point at which we can compare accounts passed on in these two different sources to get some sense about what happens on the frontier and how these stories get presented at this particular time. Now, Skookum Jim's name first appears in records in 1887. He was hired by a surveyor named William Ogilvy, who was surveying the Alaska-Yukon border, at that point the Alaska-Canadian border. And he hired Jim to carry supplies over the Pachokut Pass and marveled at how strong he was. The name Skookum comes from Chinook jargon, which was a trade language that was used at that time. And Ogilvy remarks in his journals that he felt well earned this name because he was able to carry 156 pounds of bacon over the pass. But it's very much in this sense that he was a strong person who was had earned this particular name. These are the accounts. The best known written account of Jim's adventures describe his association with a white prospector named George Carmack, who was the husband of Jim's sister, Kate. In 1896, Jim and Carmack and Kate and a nephew named Charlie did travel down the Yukon River, allegedly prospecting for gold. Pierre Burton gives us possibly the most popular and the most well-known account of this event, and his is probably the most widely read account of Klondike gold history. But his portrayal of Skookum Jim, which he gets from other written records, he's simply using the records that are available, is inevitably quite ethnocentric, like the written accounts on which it's based. But it does make Skookum Jim understandable as a folkloric hero who's attractive to readers of Klondike gold rush folklore. If we listen to the words of Burton, it's interesting because I think we can compare them later when we hear how elders speak in his community. Burton says he was a giant of a man, supremely handsome with his high cheekbones, his eagle's nose, his fiery black eyes, straight as a gun barrel, powerfully built, and known as the best hunter and trapper on the river. He goes on to say, Jim longed to be a white man, in other words, a prospector. He differed from the others in his tribe in that he displayed the white man's kind of ambition. Now, it's interesting to know where this comes from. We know this is what's passed on, but there's no evidence of this. But he's portrayed as a Euro-American folk hero, basically. Near the Klondike River, they met another prospector named Robert Henderson, who advised Carmack that he knew a good place to look for gold, and he was willing to tell Carmack what he knew, but he didn't want to share this information with his native friends. So incensed, Jim and Carmack and Charlie and Kate left, and they went on. And when they found gold a few days later in a spot very near the place that Henderson had mentioned, they didn't bother to return to tell him. So in these accounts, Henderson becomes the tragic figure, in a way, the man who's defeated by his own arrogance, by not willing to include Native people in this discovery. Uh, Jim and Kate and Charlie traveled briefly to San Francisco with their newfound wealth. According to reports that they filed, or that Carmack filed with the Yukon government, they made $200,000 in a very short time because they had the discovery claims, the two claims, upper and lower discovery claims. They made a lot of money. They went to Seattle, and they spent it Klondike style. And the newspapers from Seattle in those days report their visits and the way they were spending money. And it's talked very much again about in folkloric terms. But this glamour was really short-lived. Carmack, the white prospector, abandoned Kate. This is a photograph of Kate taken in Seattle. And it's a photograph that many people in the community of Carcross have in their homes because they were related to her and remember her. Kate abandoned her and left her penniless. He cut off all his ties with his brother-in-law, Skookum Jim. He married a white woman named Marguerite Saftig, who formerly had run a cigar store in Dawson City and never had contact with the family again. The other person who turns up in these accounts and again is remembered very much in Carcross, this is a picture of Charlie. He's known in Carcross as Dawson Charlie because he went to Dawson. Usually you see him referred to as Taggish Charlie in the accounts because in Dawson people knew that he was a Taggish man from Taggish. But his real name was Kochgeh, and he was also an important man in the community of Carcross. He came back and bought a hotel, the Carcross Hotel, but his life became more complicated after that, and he died mere 10 years later in 1909 in an accident when he fell from the Carcross Bridge. So in fact, the glamour was very short-lived, and this is also reported in the accounts. Jim continued to try to prospect, and he went to many different rivers, but he never made a big strike again, and his life became more complicated as well. He became ill during about 1912, 1913, and he died in 1916 in the community of Carcross. But what's left out from these questions is, what were these people like? We get a very, very schematic picture of them in the written records, and you know, what were they like? What were their lives like before that? Well, we get a different picture from the oral accounts, a very different picture. And if I could just talk a little bit about this. This map gives you a bit of sense of where these people are from. If I turn, can you hear me speak? Yeah. This is the map that sort of shows the route to the Yukon. Most people came up here, traveled overland, got on the river system, built their boats, and then went downriver to Dawson. And this small area here is the territory of the Taggish people and the Southern Tushone people who lived in that area. All the prospectors went through their territory. Everybody, all, 30 to 40,000 people came in that direction. So there's this question, this is the territory of the Taggish and the Southern Tushone and Tlingit people who lived in that area. And the question is what impact it had, the movement of all these people had on them. The men we've heard about and Kate, the four people, were all Taggish people themselves. And their territory encompassed this larger square, and it also, they were people who were mainly hunters and fishers who traveled very widely in the course of a year and made use of all of that land. Now, the elders who talk about them are also from this general area, from the southern Yukon, the area that's incorporated in that square to our left there. Mrs. Angela Sidney is a remarkable woman who was one of my teachers for many years, for 20 years. And she was Skookum Jim's niece. Her father and Skookum Jim were brothers. They were cousins, as she describes them, they were cousins, but in the Taggish system of reckoning, they knew each other as brothers, so he was her uncle. Mrs. Sidney has been extraordinarily active over the years in documenting place names, family histories. She has four books that she was able to publish during the years that we were working together that are used now in schools. So recording this history has been very important to her. I would also add that Mrs. Sidney was given the Order of Canada for the work that she's done recording history in 1986, and her work is very widely recognized. But she felt it was important to record her memories about her uncle. I'll mention two other ladies who also knew Cash, and then we'll come back and talk a bit more about what they had to say about him. Mrs. Kitty Smith married one of Cash's, Skookum Jim's, nephews. who wasn't actually present when the gold was discovered, but who knew the stories and heard them well. And she, when she married, she moved to Carcross and came to know Kate very, very well. So she tells the stories that she heard about the gold rush and the discovery of gold from the perspective of Kate. It's a very woman-centered account, and it's very different from the other accounts that we hear in the written record. Mrs. Smith was born in about 1890 and passed away in 1989. So she actually is one of the elders who remembered when the first prospectors came into the Yukon and was able to talk very much about that. She's also written and documented a couple of books that are now used in school based on the work that she's done. Mrs. Ned is living in Whitehorse still and talks a good deal about these times because she was also born in 1890 or 1891. Although she's not sure of the timing, but she almost married Skookum Jim. I remember being at a conference once where there was a discussion about the discovery of gold and who'd actually discovered gold, and Mrs. Ned was there, and after there'd been a long discussion with various people giving various positions, she stood up and said, "I almost married Skookum Jim," and everyone was stunned because there is this sense that this is something that happened 100 years ago, and so Mrs. Ned spoke. Mrs. Ned has also been awarded the Order of Canada. In fact, Governor General Raina Tishon came to Whitehorse in order to award that to her so that her five generations of children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and there were five generations, were able to be there, and it was a remarkable and wonderful event. And she, too, has recorded a lot of history and has booklets in her name that are now used in schools, and she's still able, because she's still with us, to be able to talk about these things to people. To approach these accounts intelligently, go back for a second to, I'm just going to tell you a few things these ladies would expect any intelligent listener to understand. There's some things that are important to understand about social behavior in the Yukon and how it was organized at that period of time. In the southern Yukon, everyone, all Native peoples are born into one of two groups. People living there call the groups Crow and Wolf. Anthropologists use the term moieties, meaning half, that the society is divided in two halves. But people are either Crow or they're Wolf, and everyone knows that. And Mrs. Smith herself is Crow. In fact, all these ladies are of the Crow clan. But Mrs. Smith would explain, if she were able to be here, that you have to understand that. The first question any young person is asked when they go to another community is, "Who's your mother?" And with the answer to that, people can place them and know where they fit into a much larger kinship system and know where they belong, so that everyone belongs. The second thing that's important to know is that by customary law, it is mandatory to marry someone of the opposite moiety, the opposite half. If you're Crow, you must marry someone who's Wolf. To marry another person who would be Crow, no matter how distantly connected, if not related even, would be like incest. So Crow people were not to marry. All Crow people must marry Wolf, and Wolf must marry Crow. But what this means is that these aren't two separate groups. It means every family has both Crow and Wolf members. One must be connected. So there's no separation. You have both. So Mrs. Smith's husband was Wolf, was one of Skookum Jim's nephews. It also means a couple of other things that are really important to the stories these ladies tell. That is that brothers and sisters all have the same clanship, the clan is their mother, but they are of the same clan, and it's very important for any man to know that he's responsible for his sisters and his sisters' children, who will also be of the same clan he is. This is very important to the stories about Cache and Skookum Jim and what happened with him. Mrs. Ned and her brother, for instance, he's been responsible for her children and has been very actively involved in their rearing, child-rearing and adulthood, because he is of the same clan they are. The final thing to know, they would say, is that these marriages connect groups of people, quite often from some distance, so that, for instance, people in the interior were connected to Tlingit people on the coast through marriages, because the same system of clans and moieties works in both communities. On the northwest coast, about the time Cache was born, Skookum Jim was born, there were some real changes happening with the fur trade. The Pacific sea otter had been exterminated by the very rapid trade on the coast, and so European traders were looking inland. They were looking in toward the territories of the Tagish people, and they were interested in furs from the interior. Tlingit people decided to be the intermediaries in that trade, and so they were the ones who went inland and got the furs and brought them back to the coast. But in so doing, there were many cases where there were marriages with people in the interior. The Tlingit people married very much intermarried with Tagish people in the southern Yukon. By the 1880s, the Tlingits were losing their power to control that trade because more and more prospectors were pushing at the margins trying to get into the territory, and it was actually in the 1890s when that trade broke down. But the marriages still continued between coast and interior, between Tlingit people and Tagish people. Now, just returning to Mrs. Sidney. Mrs. Sidney talks most about Skookum Jim because she knew him so well and because she nursed him in his final years. She says his real name was Kaish. And so he's always referred to in the community as Kaish, so sometimes as Skookum Jim, because they know that's the name outsiders know him by. But when she talks about him, she talks about his discovery of gold in very specific ways, and they're very different from the ways we hear in the Klondike written accounts. She talks about him not as an unusual or an exceptional man, but she talks about how conservative he was and how well he understood his social obligations. And she does so by telling three stories, three kinds of stories, and she does them in this order. And I think it's important to listen to them because they're not necessarily in the order that a historian would pay attention to them. She begins, the three stories are first she talks about his help from his animal helper, his frog helper, and she credits his frog helper with an enormous amount of power in the Klondike gold discovery. And I'll come back to that in a second. The second story she tells is about his understanding of Clenahiduk, who is a very complex figure in Tagish history, to whom one must behave in a particular way. Clenahiduk is a superhuman person, but behavior is very important in relations with her. The third story she tells is one that will be more understandable to us because it has to do with his social obligations to his sisters and the way he knew that he had to behave toward them. But what I think is interesting is the way we write history. The first two stories, the stories that deal with superhuman helpers and other kinds of help, extra human help, would be the kinds of things that would be written out of our history because it's a kind of causality that's not normally included when history is discussed. It's the primary thing for Mrs. Sidney and for these other ladies. So I'll mention both of these stories because they do figure into all accounts that elders give about why Skookum Jim found gold. As a young man, Mrs. Sidney said, Skookum Jim was down on the coast, and he was once casually saved a frog that had fallen into a hole, a deep hole. It was stuck. It was had no water and no access to water. Jim took the frog and took it out and took it to water and didn't think much more of it. But sometime later, when he was ill, he was injured and he had a wound that could actually have become infected. A frog came and licked the wound and she says saved his life. And so that was the first time Jim began to be aware that there was a special relationship with his frog helper. A second time, Jim had a dream in which his frog helper appeared again in the guise of a woman, and she gave him a golden tipped walking stick and pointed it down the river and said, follow this and you'll find your fortune. So people say that when Jim was going down river, he was being guided by his frog helper, and this is an important part of their view of the history. Secondly, his encounter with Clenahiduk was equally significant because she's a complex figure who people are partly afraid of and partly connected to. She's not of this world, but she's connected to this world in important ways. And when people hear her, there's a particular ritual that they're supposed to follow. They're to chase her and perform a particular ritual, and then they will always have good luck. And elders talk about how, in some cases, people have been afraid when they've heard her and may not have followed her. Other people who've tried and become frightened and have turned back. But Jim, they all say, followed her and persisted and couldn't quite catch her, but he followed her as closely as he could. And when elders talk about the tragedy that followed him later, they say perhaps if he'd actually caught her, he might have been able to have a happier life in the end. But these are the kinds of things that are written out of history, so they're not normally included. The third one will be more understandable, and it's one that I think is important to think about because it says something about society on the frontier at that point. Kaish's mother was a Tagish woman from the interior, but his father was a Tlingit man from the coast who had married into the interior and had moved inland and was seen as an important man in the interior. Now, at the time of Kaish's birth, sometime after the mid-1950s, I think probably he was born about 1970, although it's not clear at all, Tlingit influence was decreasing in the interior, but the marriages through trade still continued and were very important. And Tagish was born of such a union. Now, while superhuman explanations help Tagish people to explain something about the discovery of gold, all these women talk about his important sense of his obligations to family. I have a slide here that I was reluctant to show, and it may be hard to see from the back, but I think it's important because it shows something about how family history is connected. I always think that genealogies look like electrical circuitry diagrams and are hard to understand, but normally they're shown from top to bottom, but in Carcross, people are trying to use the names again, and so people are doing them sometimes from left to right so that they can write the names, the individual names of people, in ways that they can be read and can be used and continue to be used in the community. I'll use this just as a way of explaining. The important thing to see here is that Skookum Jim's parents, Kachkawa and Gustutin, had a large family. They had eight children who survived to adulthood. There were some, Mrs. Sidney says, who died as children, but in the 1890s, by 1885 to 1890, there were eight adult children from this marriage. The eldest were Clouch and Cache, the two brothers were the eldest, and then there were six sisters. Now, when Mrs. Sidney tells her own family history, she incorporates this as part of her family history as well, and she talks about what happened to that family during this period when the epidemics really were sweeping the coast in some ways. Skookum Jim and his brother both married to Tlingit women on the coast. The eldest brother married a woman and moved down to Skagway. And very soon after that marriage, he died. Very soon after that marriage, he died. He passed away, and which meant that Cache was the eldest brother. He was suddenly the brother who had six sisters for whom he was responsible. Another sister also married down to the coast, and she died almost immediately in one of the epidemics. And because marriages were seen as unions between communities, between groups of people rather than between individuals, the husband's family said that another sister from that family should come to be the new wife. And this was important. Everyone understood that this is the way things should work. So another sister, Auge, married the first husband and moved down to the coast. But almost immediately, her husband died in the epidemics. And again, I think it's hard to imagine what was happening at this period of time. There were so many deaths from the epidemics. Her husband died, but his brother was made her husband, because again, the relationship was between communities, so she married his brother. They had two children, two girls, Louise and Susie, both of whom are remembered as grandmothers of many people in the Yukon Territory. But then the second husband died in a fight that was involved about who should be able to pack over the coast. So in a matter of 2 years, this woman had lost her elder brother, her elder sister, and two husbands. And it all became too much for her, Mrs. Sidney says. And so she went back to the central Yukon, back home, left one of the children with her mother, and then went down the Yukon River with a prospector named Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson may have been part of the Wilson and Healy Trading Company on the coast, but she became the first of Skookum Jim's sisters to go down the river with a white prospector. Mrs. Sidney goes on to talk about the other sisters. Another sister, Kuye, remained in the community, and she had several children. Among them were the nephews who went with Jim when he went downriver looking for his sisters later. But another sister, the deaths continued with the other sisters. One, Kate, whom we've seen a picture of, married a man on the coast, and he died. At the same time, her sister in the interior had married a white prospector named George Carmack, and she died. So the mother, people were becoming forced to improvise in some ways. The mother insisted that Kate should come back from the coast and marry her deceased husband's, or her deceased sister's husband. In other words, that she should marry the white prospector. And then Carmack and Kate went down the river. So Skookum Jim's second sister, another sister, went down the river with a white prospector. The final sister died when she was coming back from a potlatch in another community at Champaign. She came over the mountain pass with her baby coming back and was caught in a freak storm in the spring, and she died. And so suddenly, within a period of about 7 or 8 years, this family of eight adults was reduced to Jim, two sisters who'd gone down the river, and he had no idea where they were, and one sister who remained in the community of Carcross. So elders are absolutely unified when they talk about what Jim was doing. They say he wasn't looking for gold, he was looking for his sisters, which presents a very different kind of picture. And again, it gives us a picture of a man who's very much a responsible man, trying to do what he has to do as a Tagish man rather than as a white prospector who's hunting for gold. If we listen to the words of Mrs. Sidney and compare them with the words that we heard from Pierre Burton, we see this contrasting picture. Mrs. Sidney says, in the first place, I'll just mention this on. This is Kate, the second sister who went down river. Auget and Kate were the two sisters. Mrs. Sidney says, in the first place, he wasn't looking for gold. Skookum Jim went down river to look for his two sisters because people missed them. They were gone for 2 years already. No telegram, nothing. He didn't know whether his sisters were alive or not, and that's why he thought he'd go down the river too to see if he could find those sisters, Auget and Kate. They were strict about that kind of thing, the old people. So Mrs. Sidney associates him with the old people, the conservative old people who were traditional, who were strict about that kind of thing. And again, it's a very different kind of picture than we hear from the other record. She goes on to describe how a party was selected to go, who was chosen to go, who stayed behind, and why. Her own parents, she says, went as far as Lake LaBarge. And when they got there, as any of you know who've been to Lake LaBarge, when you look back south, you can see Montana Mountain, which is remembered by Mrs. Sidney as Chilijutla in the Tagish language. She said that her parents looked back, and her mother started to cry and said, what will happen if we're gone all winter? Who's going to look after your mother and my sister and your father, and who's going to look after the older people? So she said her parents decided to go back. They decided to go back to look after people. And she often speculates. She often says, I wonder what it would have been like if my parents had gone too. They might have been rich, but then look what happened. It wasn't all happy for those who became wealthy. Mrs. Smith's husband, Mrs. Smith who married Skookum Jim's nephew, was one of Mr. Smith's husband. He was one of the youngsters who was left behind too. And when she married him, she heard a lot about what he had to say about that. He always wished that he'd been able to go, she says, but he stayed to look after his mother, Kuye, and the others. And when Mrs. Smith talks about this, she talks about what she heard from Kate Carmack. And she talks about it in this way. She says, like Mrs. Sidney, she says, Kate Carmack told me all this. They weren't looking for gold. They were looking for her. And her account talks about how the only reason they were able to be successful and to go as far as Dawson and find gold is because they had Kate, who was a very competent hunter and fisherwoman, who was able to look after them. She said he was all right. George Carmack, the prospector, was all right. He had a wife. She knew what to do. She looked after him. She talks about how Kate was a good fisherwoman and was actually able to find food and often gave food away to other people she met. In other words, she's seen as a person who made it all happen. Mrs. Smith's description, like Mrs. Sidney's, makes the discovery of gold absolutely incidental. It's incidental to the main story. People were doing something else, and yes, they happened to find gold, but this is not the main story. This is not the main event. The discovery is not the event. In both cases, stories about the aftermath of the gold rush in the community focus on the interplay between wealth and tragedy, because things did become more difficult. Kate was abandoned by her white husband. She came back to Carcross. She never made any money. She never got any. Her brother and her nephew both made money, but Kate never did. More troubling to everyone in the community is the fact that Kate had a daughter named Graffy, and George Carmack managed to take her away and send her to a school further south, somewhere in the United States. And there was this whole sense that child was lost to the community, which is particularly troubling in a situation where descent is matrilineal and where a child belongs with her mother's people. But Kate passed away in the flu epidemic in 1920, and she's virtually written out of the history of the Klondike Gold Rush, even though locally she's seen as having a very important role. Life also became more complex for Jim. His wife left him after a few years because his life had become more complicated with the discovery of gold. Her parents were disturbed by that, Mrs. Sidney says, and sent her back, but she wouldn't stay. And she took one of their children. There were two children. She took her son, and the daughter, Daisy, remained with Jim. Dawson Charlie's wife, Sadis Gay, left as well, and alcohol played a part in his accidental death a few years later. But Daisy, the youngster who's pictured here, had a complex life as well. She went off to school. Her father saw that she had schooling in Southern California, somewhere in the United States as well. But she went to California to study acting at one point. And Mrs. Sidney says she even had a small part in some Hollywood films. But she wanted to come back to Carcross. She wanted to be part of that community. And when her father was ill, Mrs. Sidney says, she came back in 1914, 1915 and wanted to stay. And she asked Mrs. Sidney to help find an appropriate person for her to marry. Mrs. Sidney said she went and she talked to all the men of the appropriate clan, but they all said, she's too much white woman. Who wants to marry a white woman? And so Daisy's life was a more tragic one as well. She married twice. Her health deteriorated, and she died in 1938. Well, what do these stories really tell us? The stories persist. They're very, very different kinds of stories, I think you'll agree, and they persist in popular memory, and they will be discussed even more in the next couple of years. One of the reasons I think they're powerful, both sets are powerful, is that they're rooted in general social concerns, and they dramatize areas of life that are really complicated. They talk about two things. They talk about cultural ideals, about how people should behave, both the prospector stories and the stories told in the community. But they also explore the contradictions and how difficult it is for those things to happen. They both tell us a lot, I think, about cultural values on the frontier at that point in time. One of the critical differences, and there are many differences, but one that's worth mentioning, I think, is the difference in the way the categories of individual and society get constructed in these two stories. Those are categories that we sometimes take for granted, I think, but which were very, very troubling at the time, and I think still tend to be troubling in some ways. But those boundaries, the boundaries between the idea of individual and society are established very differently at different times, different places, in different cultural contexts. Let's go back to our gold rush stories. Between 1896 and 1898, tens of thousands of men came through Tagish territory on their way to the Klondike River. And for them, the question of individual autonomy was really problematic. Their commitment to goals of individual success and material wealth were probably influenced by the fact that many of them were unemployed. They were coming from a period, it was a period of time when there was unemployment and when there was a serious depression. Many of these men would have been familiar with the immensely popular stories by Horatio Alger, which promoted the idea of ideology of individualism and plucky self-reliance. Horatio Alger, for any of you who have seen his books, and some of you will have, lived between 1832 and 1899, and he wrote 120 books, all with these themes, which sold apparently 20 million copies. That made him one of the very influential writers of his day. But in all of Horatio Alger's stories, characters often succeeded in spite of poverty, in spite of deprivation. So Skookum Jim, the way he's portrayed in these accounts that we see written, could have been a character in one of Horatio Alger's books. He's portrayed as a rather flat, one-dimensional character, a lone prospector whose efforts are ultimately rewarded. Prospectors brought their myths, both about themselves and about their society, to the Klondike Gold Rush. And they're about two things, I think. They're about the possibility of self-transformation through discovery of gold, when one can become rich. But they're also about social hierarchy. And indigenous people fit into that social hierarchy at the bottom. Native peoples are very rarely mentioned in any of the accounts that we see from the Klondike from that period. And when they do, I think they mirror the values that are sometimes reflected from that period. They're largely invisible in the accounts of people who pass through their territory, maybe mentioned, but usually as part of the landscape, not as actors. When they do engage with the prospectors and become actors, though, as Skookum Jim did, there are two kinds of imagery. They can either be included in the accounts, included in some way, or they can be excluded. There are a number of stories, which I didn't talk about tonight, where there were incidents of conflict between prospectors and Native people. And in those accounts, the written accounts are invariably racist and very critical of indigenous culture and very ethnocentric, but they tend to exclude people entirely from those accounts. Jim, however, his accidental discovery of gold qualified him for inclusion in the accounts, but he was included in ways that made sense to prospectors and gold rush people interested in the gold rushers, so he earned these dubious compliments such as race or an Indian who wanted to be a white man, all of which had very little to do with Cage, but probably had a lot to do with prospectors' ideology. They also, in these accounts, I think he really shows the advantages of needing to confirm the new social order which was being established in the Yukon at that time, which was very problematic, but certainly changing. The other further level at which I think this is problematic is including Skookum Jim as the discoverer of Klondike gold in Canadian history. Also casts this in a different way. It both recasts Native values in Euro-Canadian terms, and in some ways it naturalizes the events so that it's almost as though Jim and his family can be blamed for the kinds of things since they were involved in the discovery of gold. I think that's a very complex way in which these images do get included in our written history. But Tagish people were facing very different kinds of problems at that point. They didn't have any problems with individual autonomy because every Tagish man and woman learned as a child to be self-reliant and to be able to provide for oneself and also for others. Their problems had to do with community and with trying to hold together a community that was under enormous impact from economic dislocation, epidemics, death, illness. Their major concern was how to hold together the social group. And so when they talk about Jim, their values reflect that as well. They talk about him as a man who had long-standing continuity with Tagish values. He had a spirit helper. He had a successful encounter with Clenahiduk. He was committed to carry out his clan obligations. He was committed to his sisters. He did what a conservative man should do and did do. Now, I think all societies have characteristic narrative forms that help us to remember and think about and integrate process experience in some ways. And the stories about Kesh are a good example of how these stories can be very different. The underlying theme in Gold Rush popular literature serves really to explain the expansion, colonial expansion, and the takeover of the lands of people, the native people in that area, and the social administration which followed. That Gold Rush ideology, I think, is very much connected with the notion of expanding to the margins of North America. From oral tradition, though, we hear stories of resistance, even though Kesh's attempts to find his sisters really ended in tragedy, in personal tragedy in some ways, they're still told, these stories are still told 100 years later to emphasize the importance of those values, the importance of community rather than individual circumstance, and the attempts to maintain cultural autonomy and under circumstances of tremendous dislocation. In conclusion, then, I just want to come back to the question that I raised at the beginning, this problem about how to integrate or include contributions from oral tradition into a broader understanding of the past. I think if there are lessons to be learned from Gold Rush narratives, they're not about the cultural relativity of texts or cultural relativity. Yes, these stories are different, but they're also hierarchically arranged. There are certain ones that have power and certain ones that don't. There are certain ones that get transported into the text that we read as children in school, and there's certain ones that are left in the community that are passed on verbally. In academic writing, I think a number of us have sort of abandoned the idea of trying to develop or to write seamless, inclusive, all-encompassing narratives about the past, and yet we still believe, at least a number of us do, that there is a real world out there and that there are things that are important to describe, particularly about relations of power. I think that what these stories point to is that paying attention to the stories maybe takes us away from looking at facts, the idea of the facts, and looking more toward social process in which all these accounts are embedded, including our own accounts, including the accounts that we write now. The strongest reason, I think, for continuing to think about this problem comes from First Nations people's sense themselves of their historically rooted identity and the need to make that part of Canadian understanding of history. We really need to think critically about all the images that we have, both in film, in media, in historical writings, in academic and popular writings, and to try to understand something about how they factor into the social processes that shape Canadian history and how they connect different generations, different times, and different places. I think we'll have an opportunity to hear many more of these stories in the next couple of years as the Klondike Gold Rush is commemorated or celebrated, and I think it will be interesting to see how this problem is dealt with in that literature. Thank you very much.
Well, we now have an opportunity to ask Professor Cruikshank any questions, if anybody would like to.
Can't speak for Pierre Burton, but I think. See, I'm taking this off. Sorry. Oops, this, can you hear me through this? Fine. I think that the question is about how this is going to be represented has a lot to do with how First Nations decide in the Yukon, and this is a really important issue for people. First Nations have just gone through this period of commemoration of the Alaska Highway. The 50th anniversary of the Alaska Highway occurred 2 years ago, and that became a real issue for people. Thinking about how they want to deal with that, and there's not a simple agreement. There are some people who feel that it's important to make apparent the issues of how tragically this affected people's lives, and there are other people who say we've got other more important things to deal with than commemorating centennials that are set up to commemorate events that we don't even consider events. So I think that I'm very interested to see how people decide that. That to me is the most important question. I was talking with a young woman in Dawson City this week a couple of times, actually, who's a First Nations woman who's involved in trying to put together a museum exhibit about this. And she says that there's a real difference of opinion about how this should be handled. But most people are saying, you know, when we can commemorate our own culture, then we'll have our own centennial. We don't need to celebrate these other ones. So I'm not at all sure. I think it raises really interesting questions, and I think the answers aren't simple. But. Well, my understanding from what Mrs. Sidney and Mrs. Ned and Mrs. Smith would say about that is that people knew gold was there, but it didn't have any particular importance at all. Its importance comes from its economic value in the larger economy, the world economy in a way. So that's when people started paying attention to it. The ladies really say that Cash sort of wasn't even sure entirely what he'd found when he found gold, but he knew that they were prospecting for something, so he showed people. But it didn't have. People were far more concerned about copper. In traditional stories, copper is very important, but gold, I think, is kind of, it's just another mineral. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's also arbitrary. We could make anything valuable, any mineral we wanted, and it has a certain currency in certain ways, but that at least would be how those ladies would respond, I think. People talk more about copper with reference to that too. No, there were certainly copper was something that was used and was traded with the Tlingit people on the coast were very interested in the copper sources in the interior, but I don't think gold had any, at least from what I've heard, I don't think gold had any particular place in prior to it becoming an object of interest to outsiders. I just think that there were metals weren't really used, but except for copper, and so gold was another stone. There are eight First Nations languages spoken in the Yukon, which makes it very, very complex for First Nations communities trying to have their language programs in schools. I was extremely fortunate to have a teacher named Gertie Tom who taught me over many years with very persistent hard work to speak Shoshone, one of the languages, Shoshone, enough that I can speak and can understand it. But this is a problem because there are, in each of the languages, there are only a certain number of speakers. There's very serious concern about Aboriginal languages in the Yukon, and there's an Aboriginal Languages Commission as well as a Yukon Native Language Center, so that languages are being taught in the schools, but
but people are constantly faced with the fact that since the different communities speak different languages, it's hard to have the kind of program you might have, say, if you in Cree schools, where Cree is a language that's spoken very broadly. But I learned, because I worked with a linguist who was extraordinarily good, and with Mrs. Tom, who was an extraordinarily patient teacher, I did learn some, but I would never say that I was fluent in... The general, what most people say is that people who were born after the construction of the Alaska Highway, which is 1942, learned English as a first language. They'd certainly know their Aboriginal languages as well, but they would know English as well. These ladies, Mrs. Ned, Mrs. Smith, and Mrs. Sidney, were very fluent in English. They debated hard about how to have things recorded, because while they felt it was important to record things in Aboriginal languages, they really wanted an audience. They wanted their work available in schools, so they chose to record things in English as well as in Aboriginal languages so that they could have their books produced rapidly and while they were well. So they spoke English very well. Mm-hmm. The Yukon's a funny place because the Alaska Highway really did have an enormous effect on languages at that point in time.
Question.
Dr. Kirkchan, this is not about the war before us, but I lived in Yukon in the 1560s, and Charlie Taylor told me that have I ever seen Native twin? I had to admit no, and he said that being nomadic, twins could not survive, so they left one and carried on.
I don't think it's entirely true. I think in a lot of cases it might have been impossible for twins to both survive in cases where people were actually moving, because there was a great deal of movement involved. But I've never heard anyone say that that was specifically the case. I think that there are a lot of images about Aboriginal people that get sort of popularly passed on in discussions like that in the Yukon quite often, and often there isn't necessarily a basis in fact for that. But it was very hard. When people talk about how hard it was hard to have twins, because it's very hard to have two small children, two babies at the same time when you're moving quite often. There certainly are twins who I know in the Yukon, but that who were born that period, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. So I guess probably I can't really answer that for an earlier period.
Was spoken in unusual, or did a Native American not find it difficult to get Skookumjim recorded if they found it?
This is a very good question, because in fact Skookumjim couldn't record that claim. I should probably have said that. Carmack, there was a debate about how to do it, and Carmack filed the claim for both Charlie and for Jim. And then accorded, gave them half of the claim in that way. But at that point, he wasn't allowed to stake himself. I don't know when that changed. I don't know when those laws changed.
Professor Kirkstead, actually, with the advent of the Oshkosh Indians now in the last part of the 20th century, and I have dealt with people from the Liberal Red Tribe for a number of years, how can you measure the turn? They're getting up more towards the belt covenant and land covenant. You know, we don't often hear this because I live on the family here.
I'm sorry, I don't think I quite heard your question. How can you determine
the approximate motive leading towards the land bank and self covenant with the two divisions?
Right. I think that those are issues that are being debated and discussed in communities now. I can't say that I determined any of those things. I was certainly there while people were having those discussions, and I found that really exciting. There's a very strong commitment to the notion of self-government, to land claim settlement in the Yukon, which is almost finally in place, although it still seems to be not fully implemented. It's really interesting. I should have probably mentioned the third lady you saw, Mrs. Ned, is the mother of Elijah Smith, whom some of you would know as the architect of the Yukon land claims, actually. He was a man who certainly, with others, had a vision that there was a possibility of solving this and resolving this. It's hard to know. Now, one of the things that's different about the Yukon is that there were no treaties whatsoever, as there are, as is the case certainly in large parts of British Columbia. But because there was a willingness of the federal government to negotiate possibly earlier than there has been in this province, there was also, as you know, in this province, there's a complication of the provincial government being involved in those deliberations. And in the north, I think it was more straightforward because negotiations were with the federal government and Aboriginal people. But that process began in the late 1960s and continued through the 70s and has been very much in process in the 80s and now in the 90s.
Question at the back.
In your stories about from a Native perspective and from a European or Canadian perspective, you talk about the Native perspective being about process and being about family. What kind of a larger narrative does that fit into? Does it fit into a larger narrative about Native contact with Europeans where the gold rush is just one passing phase? Or does it fit into a larger narrative about family? And therefore, what is that larger narrative about Skookumjim's family past the death of Kate?
I think that, and again, I'm just speaking from what I've heard from these women who've taught me about this, I think that the narrative in those communities for that whole period of time is about family. Social organization is about the relationship between crow and wolf. All social behavior is interpreted within that larger understanding of kinship and family. It's very, very different from the way we now in industrial Western economy see ourselves as individuals in isolated nuclear families. In those communities, family can mean hundreds of people because there are these connections that people can document or can connect with one another, and so everything's told from that perspective. I think the point I'm trying to make with these comparing these narratives is that the stories that are told in the Yukon will always be about family and about connection to other people through kinship. The people who came and whom they encountered, the prospectors, had a different narrative, which was about individual accomplishment and individuality and individualism. I'm not sure if that really explains your question, but I think that any narrative that people would tell in the Yukon about history or about events or about the past would be deeply embedded in connections with other people. Yes, yes. She's his younger sister, and he also talked about all of these same events. He as well knew Jim very well. But yes, she is.
Just a detail. Was Cache Wolf?
Yes, he was. Sorry, I should have said that. He was a wolf member of the Doctowaiti clan, which is the clan, the named clan.
See, one question that may have occurred to others, it certainly did to me. What happened in intertribal marriages? Did wolf and crow work that way mm-hmm. too?
There is really, truly through... Certainly through the Yukon and down the coast to Tlingit communities on the coast, this same system. It's actually a system of understanding relationships that's very common throughout the world. But between those communities, it's really consistent, so that people immediately understood the relationship of raven. Crow is sometimes called raven. But those relationships are consistent throughout the Yukon and throughout southeastern Alaska, certainly.
Well, there are no other... Oh, pardon me, one more.
Sure. I noticed that you worked mainly, or you seem to work mainly with First Nations women, and I was wondering if that tells us something about who is considered an authority or who is considered the carter among the Yukon people.
Thanks, Shirley. I think that's an important point, too. Would you like me to repeat the question? I have the mic. Shirley's asking, she mentions that I have worked mostly with First Nations women, and she wonders whether that says something about the importance of women as the guardians of knowledge and the important storytellers. Is that correct in the Yukon? I think it says something about that, and it also says something about gender and me too, because when I began working originally with people in the Yukon, I was interested in talking to both men and women, and invariably when I talked with men who were elders, Mr. Johns, Johnny Johns, who was mentioned a moment ago, for instance, they would say, yes, this is interesting, but really I'd rather talk with a man because he can understand more about the kinds of things I have to talk about, like hunting, which you don't know anything about, and also because it's more appropriate for me at that point as a younger non-Native woman to be working with women. So, but I've asked Mrs. Sidney about that a whole lot, you know, and she says that in the older days when she was a child, that at ceremonial occasions or at potlatches, it would be the men who were the speakers, who gave the formal speeches, but that when you really listened to what, who told people and who passed on knowledge, the women were doing it all the time with themselves, with each other, and with their children. So it may say something about a particular kind of knowledge, and it may say something about these particular narratives which are embedded in questions of family and community and the relationships. Mr. John's, Mrs. Sidney's brother, wouldn't have been able to make such a complicated family tree as this. He would always refer me to his sister as someone saying that women knew about these things and they knew how everyone was related. So I think your question is well asked.
One last question.
Yes. Oh, the question was, have there been many missionaries in the Yukon, and how has this basically influenced the kinds of social processes I think you're really asking, is that the case? Yes, in the Yukon, there were very early, the Anglican Church was active in the northern Yukon from the 1860s, 1870s. In the area that these ladies come from, the missionaries came directly as a result of the gold rush. The Bishop Bompas, who was an Anglican minister missionary at that time, decided that because it's a result of the gold rush, there should be an establishment of a church further south in Carcross and a residential school, which was built at Carcross in the community where Mrs. Sidney lives. So I think that the residential schools probably were the longest term effect of missionary activity. It's been mostly Anglican Church missionaries and also Roman Catholic missionaries, but the Roman Catholic missionaries operated more further south in northeastern British Columbia and closer to the Alaska border. So the Anglican Church has been the main church in those communities. There are a number of people, including Mrs. Sidney herself, who would consider herself a strong Anglican, though. It's people have a very complicated relationship with the church, I think, in those communities. And yes, the church has had a lot of effect, though.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask Professor Pat Marshak, the Dean of Arts, to thank our speaker tonight.
It's a very, very special pleasure for me to be able to thank Dr. Cruikshank. I happened to be the head of the Department of Anthropology and Sociology when we had the opportunity to offer her an appointment, and to our tremendous delight, she accepted, and the department has been congratulating itself ever since. Julie, this was a wonderful talk indeed. A very modest statement on your part that, although I understand the philosophical basis for it, it was also a modest statement that, well, this wasn't just a matter of relativity of versions of history. And you were, in a sense, letting Pierre Burton off the hook, I think. Well, and we must be kind to Pierre Burton because he's also one of our illustrious graduates. But there are indeed different versions of history. And I think that while it is certainly true that in the history of Canada, in the history of the industrial nations generally, a different version has been dominant, we are surely going through a very great change in our history, in our versions of history, in our understanding of the social processes. And I think that what you're doing is helping us to see a very different way of looking at the history And I think we're very much indebted to you. Wonderful talk. Thank you ever so much.
Just to remind you as you leave that next week's speaker is Dr. Murray G. Smith, the director of the Institute for Trade and Law at Carleton University and the University of Ottawa. After NAFTA, where do we go from here?